To see examples of what we talked about on this episode, along with further information, go to bunchofdorks.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to
Two Dimension Podcast,
the comic book podcast
with no direction. All right, you heard the song, so you know what you're listening to. All I want to say is we are shaped by our thoughts. We become what we think. When the mind is pure, joy follows like the shadow that never leaves.
Okay. And the shadow knows.
Yes, he does.
Speaking of shadows, did you like Howard Chaykin's take on the shadow back in the 80s?
Yes.
Did you appreciate it? You did like it.
I loved it. What did you think?
I thought it was like Howard Chaykin's take on the shadow.
Oh, yeah, I see.
You know, cynical, you know, that kind of stuff or whatever. Like he did on Black Hawk and all that stuff. But you did like it, huh? Okay.
Yeah, I guess you got to kind of frame something here. Like what Al said is 100% correct. It was his take on something, and it was cynical and this and that. But I love Howard Chaykin's work. So to me, I read it from, I guess, a different view. I just enjoy it. The Black Hawk series I bought and I liked, but I guess I don't really remember that much greatness to it. The Shadow, I do. Especially that first issue, it was a 4-issue series. But how he put that thing together, especially at the end when Lamont Cranston showed up. And how he put the story together and how it paced, it just kept hitting. He was playing around because there was, I don't know a lot about the Shadow, but I guess there was more than one.
There was. It was more than Lamont Cranston.
Yeah, and there was another guy. I don't. In his series, there was an old guy that was going around doing birthday parties as a Shadow.
Oh, you're talking about Chaykin's one, the original one. Okay,
but I think there were Shadow stories about another Shadow, or
of the original.
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
All I know is Chaykin's thing, so I'm just assuming. But so I was a little confused because I never really read The Shadow. I knew of the character. But, I thought it was great. And it just kept going. He had to tie it into Shangri-La and all the other stuff happening.
You like Mike Kaluta's better, right?
I never read Michael Kaluta's.
You never read those old Shadows back in the 70s?
No.
Not even the collections of them? Wow.
No, I know. That's a shock because I love Michael Kaluta. I didn't buy those. When those came out, I was 9. And I was heavily into Superman and, you know, Batman, Legion of Superheroes, all that stuff. I love those. But mostly what I liked was the reprints they were putting behind the main story, like the Green Lantern, Green Arrow issues I was buying. I'd read the Denny O'Neill, Neil Adams books, the story, and, you know, I sort of liked them. They just kind of made me feel bad. But they always had a Gil Kane, you know, the Green Lantern story behind it that just thrilled me. And I remember when Swamp Thing, they were advertising it. I never bought them.
But you've read the Swamp Thing.
Oh, yeah, I've got all the reprints of those.
Yeah.
Joe Kubert's Tarzan, I never read those. I like Tarzan.
So you were just buying superheroes when you were 9?
Yeah, I was buying superheroes. Now, I talk about this a lot. When I was in 7th grade, there was a lot of kids starting to collect comics. And there was kids that already collected comics for a long time. And this one kid, he was a year older than I was. And we were talking, and he was always referring to the valuable comics. The first DC Tarzan, The Shadow, Swamp Thing, you know, he was referring to those, which, again, I had no interest. I didn't know Michael Kaluta did those. I did buy a Shadow story, but it was Frank Robbins.
Oh.
You know? And the only reason I bought it was because everybody was telling me it's valuable and you should get these. So I bought it, not really wanting it, and I didn't really enjoy it. Of course, it wasn't, you know, Michael Kaluta. I didn't find out Michael Cluda did it until I bought that book, The Studio.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and I thought, what, Michael Cluda did that? Because to me, Michael Cluda wasn't a comic book artist. He was like a fantasy illustrator. And again, my buddy Britt, he says, yeah, he did some of the early ones. But no, I like Howard Chaykin's Shadow quite a bit. I didn't read, the DC did a series with him. I think Bill Sienkiewicz and Andy Helfer did it.
Yeah, they did. I didn't read those, but I remember seeing them.
Yeah, I didn't read those either. I like Bill Sienkiewicz, but... Yeah.
Well, it's weird, because you sent me the that interview with Chaykin, and I listened to, like, the first half, the first segment of it, and I was just listening to it, and it seems like... Maybe you like him, because to me, it's like the Howard Chaykin that I listen to sounds like the complete opposite of you. You know what I mean?
Oh, thanks.
And I'm not going to criticize Howard Chaykin or say anything. I'm just saying, to me, it's like you're a completely different kind of guy.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I was scared to death when I met him in 82. I mean, I never really knew much about Howard Chaykin. I liked his work. And I wasn't really... You know, I didn't read all the fanzines and periodicals. You know, I just read Epic Illustrated and the comics and heavy metal and stuff like that. But for some reason, I still had a feel for what he was like. And my buddy Brett and I were at Dallas at the Dunphy Hotel for a Creations convention. And the guests were Howard Chaykin, Bill Sienkiewicz. And Michael Gold ended up being showing up there, but he wasn't announced. Bob Layton was there. But I just remember walking by, and Howard Chaykin was sitting there, you know, one of the tables, and I recognized him immediately. And Brett said, that's Howard Chaykin. And then he just started talking to us. Really, you know, the same as what you hear on the radio, but he was nice. And, he wasn't doing the comic work at the time. You know, I'd see him in heavy metal once in a while. I'd see stuff he did for Star Wars and that kind of thing. But we were talking, and he was showing me some things. He says, well, that's about as close as I get to comics anymore. And I just, you know, you were seeing that happen. You know, the studio guys, they just kind of graduated from comics, it seemed, at the time. But he was nice, and he had some book covers he did. On boards, they were pretty neat wraparound paperback covers, and everybody's commenting on them, and I just asked him, how did you get those paints so flat? And because they looked like they were printed, and he immediately just grabbed them and handed them over to me and said he used them. It was an animation paint. Mm-hmm. And he said the colors are strong and it dries flat, you know, because that's what you want, you know, without any line work. And I, you know, he was just, you know, Britt was making a joke about whenever you ask other cartoonists or artists, they always say, oh, it's a trade secret. Howard Chaykin was telling us everything. And, you know, he had an opinion, but he was nice.
Yeah, because when you read his books, and they're all kind of like have a same worldview. It's very cynical, very bitter, and, you know, you get an impression that this guy's like, that's a rough guy. He may be. I don't know. I mean, I listened to that interview. He was just kind of like, whatever. You know what I mean? But I guess you got him on a good day, or he's just not what he appears to be. Let's put it that way.
Well, I think also that, you know, we're his audience, so...
He's trying to sell stuff to you.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, I think he appreciates his audience. If you would have listened to all of the interview, because the reason I sent it to you was... He was talking about one thing. What Al and I are talking about, there's a podcast called Comic Book Historians, and our friend Scott Connor sent it to me. It was two parts. I really enjoyed it. There's two different guys talking, and Howard Chaykin, basically, he talks about his career, and he tells you a bit about everything, but he's talking about how he worked for Gil Kane, which I've heard.
Yeah, I listened to that part.
Yeah. And Wally Wood, he worked at Wally Wood Studio.
Him and everybody else, it seems like.
Yeah. What did you think of what he said? That there was something, no matter what you drew, Wally Wood, when he inked it, it turned into a Wally Wood
drawing. Exactly right. We talked about that before. Yeah. He could draw it as Howard Chaykin, and it would look like Wally Wood. Yeah. No, yeah. Remember those old Hercules comic books where Walt Simonson drew it? It didn't look anything like Walt Simonson.
No. Joe Sinnott's one of those as well, and Jim Aparo. When Jim Aparo was inking John Byrne on that, I can't remember what it was called. It was a Batman.
Untold Tales of Batman.
Yeah. The first issue was John Byrne drawing, and Terry Austin was supposed to ink it, but Jim Aparo ended up. And I love Jim Aparo, but except for just a few faint poses and panels, it was a Jim Aparo comic book.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
But he talked of everything. He talked about a little bit about Atlas when he was there. He really liked it there.
Yeah.
And he talked about distribution. He talked about how comics were working. And like I said, Al's right. His work shows cynicism quite a bit, and sometimes the dystopian futures, but there's still hope in it. I mean, he still has things to it. And he'll criticize comics and all this other stuff, but at the same time, he's still part of it. He still loves it. So,
well, like that Hey Kids comics, I read the first issue of that. It's pretty cynical. Might be true, but
yeah,
the names have been changed to protect the innocent or the not so innocent. But yeah, you know, it's like ever since like Black Kiss, you know, it's been like, oh, here comes Howard Chaykin with the, you know, with the sex and the violence and all that. And then when you hear him talking, he comes off like a very liberal guy that would be, you know, offended by it, you know, what he's drawing. You know what I mean? You know, or be put off by it. I mean, that last thing that he did, did you see that video that I sent you, Comic Tropes, that guy?
No, I've got it on my phone, or I've got it on something. I haven't had a chance.
He shows, like, one of the last series that he did, the one before the Kids Comics. Man, some panels on it were pretty rough. You know, I mean, I'm sure he'd probably say, I'm doing that to show you the horror, you know, how horrible things are, but he's interesting in the sense that you don't know what his motive is for doing it, whether it's to be exploitive, or whether it's to be educational, whether to show you wrong, whether he's being ironic, or he's just being cynical. He's interesting in that sense. So,
when American Flag was announced, I went to boot camp. And like I said, I liked Howard Chaykin, and when I met him, I liked him even more. And so I was wanting to get it. When it came out, I was, again, still in training. And Britt sent me a letter and told me he got it. And he said, I've never read a comic with so much sex and violence in it. And he said, I was surprised. He says maybe he's against it and he's just showing it. Or maybe he just likes it. But I was surprised when Britt said that. And then I got American Flag. I instantly fell in love with it. I'm saying this. I'm one of the guys you hear all the time talking about, I don't care for dark and gritty comics. But I loved Frank Miller's Dark Knight series. I loved Watchmen. You know, I liked Howard Chaykin's work. I just don't want everybody doing that. You know, I like a lot of different things. But American Flag, I still look back on it as one of my favorite comics. I was really shocked that Howard Chaykin, one, was doing a monthly comic of that scale and keeping the quality up. There was all kinds of concepts and information in it that, at the time, it was new. And the artwork itself was staggering. And, you know, how Ken Brusniak was doing all the lettering, and it was integral to the story. It wasn't just added on. I absolutely loved it. And I lent this series to a friend of mine I worked with, because we were talking about comics, and, you know, we liked a lot of the same music and a lot of the same things. But when I lent him American Flag, he read it, and he said, parts of it, he gave it back. He said he liked it somewhat, He said, I just got tired of him always referring to characters as Jew boy and this and that, you know, which, you know, I understand, but sometimes I think he kind of makes a point. He doesn't pull punches.
Well, apparently he's, that guy in comic strip was saying that he's involved with Marvel in a way, because when new artists come in, he kind of gives them, I don't know what you would want to call it, like a talking, explaining them how the business works and, you know, what you're expected of and all that. So he's still involved even with Marvel Comics as far as the art training for new recruits or whatever, boot camp or whatever it is. So he's still involved in it. So, I mean, that's good, but I didn't get to the second part because it was just, I mean, I don't know if he talked about what he's doing now.
Yeah, it's more, if you don't want to, that's fine, but it's just as interesting as the first.
I'm more interested in his old work than his new work, but what did he go into in the second part?
I can't remember. Some of the stuff you're talking about, I thought was in the second part. So
no, that's in the first part. No.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised you only listened to the first part, and it's most of the stuff I remember. The second, he was talking about other plans. I don't know if he talked about Image Comics in the first one, because you know Image has been publishing his stuff, and he was talking about a lot of that and how Image isn't the Image that first started. You know,
no, Image is like a distributor almost or something. If you pay them money to promote your book, and then, you know, you get a percentage of it if it sells.
They do a good work.
It's an interesting concept anyway, but it's not the same as the seven guys that left Marvel and DC or whatever. It's not the same company, no.
They became multimillionaires.
Yeah, and in no time, and then, you know, and then the industry went into the dumpster.
Well, that wasn't just
them. That's not because of them, though. That's not just because of them. That's many other reasons. But, yeah, so, because the reason I mentioned that is because I was looking through some books, and I found this thing here, The Mark of Cain.
I can't see it, and you're not on video.
Oh, you can't see me at all?
No.
My video's gone?
It never was there.
Oh, I thought you said you could see me.
No, I could hear you.
Oh, that's so weird that you can't see me. Oh, okay, well, Marvel Premiere, The Mark of Cain. Did you ever read that back in the old days?
No.
Solomon Cain. You never read that adaptation?
I know Solomon Cain, yeah. I saw one story.
What Thomas did a two-part comic book on it. Do you remember that at all or no?
I saw one Solomon Cain story in, I think it was Our Adventures or something, or Savage Sword Conan. It was by David Winslow.
Well, he did a two-parter. I mean, I only found part two, so I read it. It's really interesting because it's Roy Thomas is writing it, but it's really, it looks like Chaykin did it over a weekend or something. It's pretty sketchy artwork, you know what I mean? And it's not bad. Again, I didn't read the first part, but he's basically like chasing, you know, this pirate into the African jungle, and he faces like a giant, you know, some natives, and then he fights them off. There's a voodoo guy, which I guess becomes like his sidekick, and he created like some sword for him that fights evil or whatever. But it was interesting in that it was just like, I could see why he said he never liked his 70s work, because it's really, really sketchy looking, and some of it is not even great storytelling. Because Roy Thomas had to put like 8 million descriptive balloons in it, I guess, to help tell the story or whatever. But it was interesting because I never really knew much about the character of Solomon Cain. I knew Conan, but I didn't know Solomon Cain. I didn't know he was a Puritan that was out to fight all evil. And supposedly they even made a movie about him a few years ago, which I had no idea about that either.
Me either.
Yes, 2011, they did a Solomon Cain movie. I think it was a semi-low budget thing, but I don't even know who the actress was. But as I was doing some research, I looked and saw, like, Solomon Cain, rated R, you know, 2011. I'm like, oh, that one went by quick. Might have straight to video or whatever, you know. But did you ever read any of the Solomon Cain stories? And
No. I knew the character, and like I said, I just saw that one story that David Wenzel drew, which is only part of the story. And I've heard people talk about they read them. A guy on my ship bought a book. He didn't know what it was. He just, you know, he'd buy it out of boredom, and the guy went around helping people, trying to straighten. You know, he was kind of like Batman, trying to straighten out the world. You know.
Yeah. It's kind of he had a supposedly a dark past, and he tried to, you know, fix it by killing all the evil in the world. Good luck.
Yeah.
But back in the 17th, but it was an interesting story for the most part. You know, I guess Chaykin was doing a lot of these Marvel premieres because there's a Monarch Star Slayer and a Dominic Fortune, yeah. And they're all in the same year, probably 76, 77. So I guess he was trying to create new or new old characters or whatever. And there was like, you know, I guess Marvel had the Robert E. Howard licensing at the time, so why not use another one of Howard's guys? They did Conan, they did Red Sonja, so I guess the other one would have been Solomon Kane.
They talked about that maybe on the second part of the episode, because that was in the podcast. He talked about some of the stuff he's doing for Marvel and why. It's interesting. One thing, there's a few things, and they talked about Star Wars. I don't know if that was in the first or second.
Yeah, it was in the first one. Yeah, it sure was.
There's a couple of things. I always loved Howard Chaykin. I always said this in the show, but I hated his Star Wars work, and I was really bitter about that. You know, the other one was, I remember he did a Micronaut story, and it was unforgivable. And I remember I was in a comic store, and some customer was talking to the owner and said something about, some artists don't do their best work. You know, they do really good work on something and really bad work. And the store owner just said, you got to watch Chaykin for that. And that's when he said that. Oh my God, yes. But that Micronaut story, I told you this on one of our early episodes. I said, who was it? Vince Coletta inked it. And you laughed and said, I'll give him a pass. Well, he talked about it, that there was some Marvel stuff he did, and they got Vince Coletta to ink it. And he said, Vince Coletta can destroy anything. And if that's true, yeah, that's far unforgivable.
Well, the one that I remember Vince Coletta inking him was the James Bond, For Your Eyes Only, maybe, or something like that.
And that's the one.
He talked about that.
Yeah, he's talking about that one because he wanted to paint the cover. And I guess Marvel didn't really want him to do it.
Mm-hmm.
There was some.
He did the insides too, didn't he? Or was that somebody else who drew it? Didn't he do the insides?
I don't know. I never read it, but he must have, because he was talking about Vince Coletta.
Yeah, sure. And yeah, I seem to remember him doing that.
I think that was the end of his Marvel work for a while.
Yeah, he went to work for Byron Price after that.
Yeah, and that's why he didn't really talk about it much. He said he didn't make any money off that, but he mentioned it. Ken Brusniak said this on Sidebar, that Howard Chaykin set up First Comics wanted Howard Chaykin to come, and basically, whatever the deal was, that was a flagship title, was American Flag, and they brought Howard Chaykin over, and he was just trying to get out of bankruptcy, so they set up some sweet deal where he made a lot of money off of it, could do what he wanted. The book sold well, and it basically pulled him up, you know, out of bankruptcy, and then he went to Hollywood. Ken Brusniak also said that, you know, it was a labor-intensive project. He was getting, this is for, people understand, before computers, you'd have to use, if you didn't hand letter things, which most people did, you'd have to get that rub-on text by chart pack or Electroset.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you'd also have to, a lot of times, hire a typesetter. You couldn't manipulate the text. I mean, a typesetter would just basically type out what they had. And it was expensive. And then you had to get it processed, you know, through film. And Howard Chaykin had all these plans and told him what he wanted. And Ken Brusniak, when he had to give him the bill, he had to give him the bill for the typesetter and all the other stuff. And he said sometimes that bill was staggering. And he was embarrassed to give it to Howard Chaykin. And when Howard Chaykin got it, Howard Chaykin was kind of floored for, you know, momentarily. He thought, well, it's what we wanted. We got to keep going. And, but Ken Brusniak, you know, you get paid a page rate. And he wasn't getting that much for the book. I mean, you know, with all the work he's doing. Well, so what First did was they also gave him the My Girl book, John Sable Freelance.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was another book that sold well. He got the same page rate, and I guess My Girl had very little text.
And if I remember, yeah, right.
So, well, you know, so he could letter the book and get paid the same, and that kind of offset all the work he was doing for American Flag.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, he considers Flag to be his best work. Chaykin does. I guess
do
he's
too.
Correct about that.
I do, too. I like the stuff he did for DC, even though I said Blackhawk, I don't remember it fondly. I mean, I have it. I like it. Whenever I see people on Facebook post pictures of covers and stuff, I liked it. I enjoyed myself. The Shadow work, I was really... I don't know, I just couldn't wait for each book to come out, all the way to the fourth book. It was neat. And he set it up for somebody else to do. And I thought he did that well. Again, Howard Chaykin, I bought the first issue of Black Kiss. And I was interested. Howard Chaykin's one of those people that, you know, I'm just going to buy. I never saw another issue of Black Kiss. Black Kiss was like, I don't know, maybe 16 pages?
Yeah, it was a little pamphlet.
Yeah, pamphlet's the right word. It was polybag, which it was the first time I ever saw a book polybagged. It was black and white. I think it had a red lipstick on the cover. You know, like it was Black Kiss, but it had a little red lips on the logo. But it was all black and white. It was nice work, but it was thin. And I bought the first, and it was more expensive than a regular comic book. You know, it was from Vortex, so it was like Mr. X and stuff, but it was more expensive than Mr. X and these other books they did. And I bought the first issue. It intrigued me. I would have read the other stories if I would have seen them. But even then, I was kind of debating because that was a lot of money for what I was getting. And, you know, I was newly married. My wife and I were just starting out. So there wasn't much disposable income. So I was, you know, I was choosing selectively what books I'd get. And a lot of it was money, you know. But so I never bought any others. I didn't realize it went on so long. I heard him in an interview talking because they were going to do Black Kiss 2. And he was really proud of that work. That's kind of funny you mention it. I just went to last Monday. I went to Nerd Out Comics, and I was looking at trades. They had the first trade and second trade of Black Kiss. I was gonna buy the first trade, but it was hardcover and kind of expensive, and it was printed by Dynamite. The second one was Image, and it was softcover, and it wasn't that much, so I bought it. And the guy in Nerd Out, he gave me a break. He said, he said, you looking for anything? I said, yeah, I was trying to find the sixth issue of Umbrella Academy. I had all the other issues. It was a 7-issue series, but I didn't have the sixth one. And he found it for me, and he said, he gave me a few bucks off of everything. So that's cool.
Is he still in that little shopping center with Grindhouse Video?
Yeah. And after I went there, I went into Grindhouse, and you know the door we went in, you know, to the
yeah.
It doesn't work. It says use other door. So what other door is there? Well, the business on the left of it isn't there. It's Grindhouse Video.
Okay.
It's funny because all the signs on that side looks like it was a law firm or something. And so I went in there, and he's got a young lady working there with him. And he's got that whole section set up. It's a big store.
So it's bigger now than it was before?
Yeah.
It's double size now?
Yeah, well, yeah. I don't I don't know if the new one's as big as the one you saw, but it's all bigger. But I think the other one's maybe a, you know.
It's in the same shopping center, yeah. Right? The little, okay.
Yeah, Grindhouse is right next to Nerd.comics, and there's that, I don't know, something records.
Yeah. I remember when Grindhouse was Grindhouse Closet.
I love going there. That was so much fun when you and I found that place. We were looking for
Yancey. We were looking for Yancey.
Yeah, in the Tampa area. And we saw the Crystal's Burger Place, which you like. And then you said there was a comic. What? We turned around. Man, that was a neat place. It was like a kid's clubhouse. And every time you went into Grindhouse, I went in with you. It was a little closet. It was fun because you went up those steps and it was wood floor. And I remember I went in, I just thought I was going to hang out. Every time I went in there, I bought one.
Something.
Usually two movies. And I was happy to get each one. I got some Japanese horror movie for $5, which I absolutely love.
In inflammation, not inflammation. It was something about an infection or something like that.
It was a great movie. I can't remember the name of it. My wife watched it with me. I've never seen anything like it, you know. And then it had I was surprised at the ending, even though it was all a surprise.
Yeah, those Japanese horror movies sometimes are a little on the rough side, but
yeah, well, this one was. It was very, I want to say uncomfortable, but it still had its moments where I enjoyed myself. It was something, but yeah, I went in this time and it wasn't as much fun going by myself, I have to say, but
no, I mean, the comic shops here are closer. They're only like 15 minutes away. Mm-hmm. I remember Nerd Out being, I was thinking about yesterday about those trips we used to make. I was like, man, I remember going like those places. It took like 45 minutes to an hour to get there. And then, but that's if you were lucky. That's if you were lucky, because when that freaking 75 traffic, that cluster in the park there was like, oh, God, I remember that.
It didn't take us like, that long. We were on the road that long.
I seem to remember, well, remember that I live 20 minutes away from you, so, you know, it seemed longer to me.
Yeah.
It was from where you lived, I would say it was over. It was about 40, 45 minutes, right, to get there. It wasn't that close. And we always got stuck in a traffic jam.
Yeah, well, no, you tell me about you got stuck in traffic jams. When you're with me, you say, well, this is fast. Well, we didn't go during rush hour.
But Saturdays, man, it was bad, too, if I remember correctly. Saturdays were bad on that highway.
No, because every time we did shows driving there, and you'd always say, wow, this is a lot easier.
Okay, I just remember them being crappy.
Well, yeah.
People 75.
What I was talking about where we live was Pinellas County, which is St. Petersburg. It's a little tip off of Tampa. And except for one strand, everything goes by bridges. And they're super long bridges. And the traffic on that bridge during rush hour, which starts about, I don't know, 3:30, sometimes earlier, to sometimes about 6 at night, it's not fun. The guy I work with, his wife worked in Tampa when they first moved down here, and then she got a job down here, and sometimes he asks about barbecue places and stuff. I'll tell him about this really good one in Tampa or something in Tampa, and I was telling him about that Tampa theater, that movie theater, which is awesome, and he's like, oh, my wife won't go to Tampa. Well, it's because she drove that bridge every day in rush hour traffic. It's not fun.
Yeah, tell me about it.
But you were traveling back and forth, and you were getting stuck in Russia, and I'm sorry about that. But no, I went to Wilson's last week on Saturday, and I was looking for Michael Olmien is doing a Dick Tracy book for IDW called Dick Tracy Forever, and I wasn't getting any books in my subscription box, and I said, did the guy ever get my note? And so the lady sent it again. I was getting Usagi Jimbo. You know, he moved over to IDW, which, you know, I like Usagi Jimbo no matter what. But I got the first issue of it. and I got the first issue of Walt Simonson's Ragnarok. He's doing a second series. And I got the third issue of Dick Tracy Forever. So I thought, well, this bites. So I went looking for the first two issues. So I drove over to comics and stuff, and they didn't have it. You know, I was in there for a while, and then I thought, all right, I'll go to, I haven't been to Nerd Out since you were here. So I've never seen their new location. So I drove over there and I asked about the Dick Tracy books, and he said, no, he says, I've got a couple, but they were subscription only, special order only, so he doesn't even carry them. I don't think anybody's carrying them. I saw them at Yancey last time we did an episode of Rug, but I didn't buy them because I was thinking, well, they'll have them at Wilson's, and boy, was I wrong.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how comic shops do it anymore, but that's another story for another day. Hey, we're at the 35-minute mark. Let's take a break, and you know, so Dallas doesn't get mad.
Okay. All right. See ya.
You can hear our most recent 20 episodes on iTunes. If you would like to hear our older episodes, you can find them on our blog. Just go to bunchofdorks.com and click on the Cyclops.
Your Dimension can be found on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. If you like what you hear, you can subscribe, rate, leave a review, tell a friend, or like us on Facebook. Thanks for listening.
And we're back. That was This Mortal Coil with a cover of a Big Star song, yet another Alex Chilton reference. And not really, no, it's not really a Big Star song. It's a Chris Bell song, who was the main guy behind the first album, the first Big Star album, but then he left. Anyway, the song is called You and Your Sister. So there you go. It was a single put out years later for anybody out there who cares.
You know, you haven't talked about Alex Chilton in a long time, and I think people maybe listening now don't know the reference. Can you tell us a little bit about Alex Chilton and your love for him?
Alex Chilton was kind of like a child prodigy singer. I think when he was like 15, he joined the group The Box Tops, and he had a million-selling hit with The Letter. They released a few albums. They broke up. He went back to, Memphis, Tennessee, whatever he was from, New Orleans. No, it was Memphis. And he was just hanging around, and these other guys there had some bands going on, and they were very, this is like 71, very much influenced by the Beatles. Chilton was recording, too. He was doing solo stuff. So this guy, Chris Bell, had a band, and he was trying to get like a four-piece, and they found Chilton. They were seeking him out. Said, hey, you want to be in this band? Here's some of the material we have. And he liked it. It was kind of like power pop. Not power pop, but Beatles influence. Let's put it that way. But it was different. So he joined the band, called themselves Big Star. They put out an album. It bombed because it was picked up by the Stax label, which was mostly a soul label. And they didn't know what to do with it. And then they got stuck in a bad distribution deal with a major. I don't remember which one it was. So the record got buried, but it kind of became an underground hit because radio stations were like, hey, I've never heard of this, but this is really good. And some stations started playing it. So the band broke up. Chris Bell went on his own, went to record. I guess he came from money, and his brother took him over to England and recorded some stuff, which didn't get released until posthumously years later. And then Chilton, for all intents and purposes, the band was broken up, but one of the management people or one of the people behind Big Star had an idea to bring all these rock and roll critics from the early 70s, from Cream Magazine, Rolling Stones, and do a showcase for what was left of Big Star. So they got Chilton in the band without Chris Bell to rejoin as a three-piece. They brought all these, Cameron Crowe, Lester Bangs, all these people to Memphis, Tennessee to watch Big Star play songs, and everybody loved it. So then they decided to do another album, which was their second album. That flopped. Also, bad distribution deal. Nobody picked it up. But again, it became a cult favorite because it's like everything else. When you hear an album that never gets released, but it's got really good songs on it, becomes a big deal. So then the band really broke up again, but Chilton went into the studio, recorded a really depressing but great record called Sister Lovers with the drummer and other musicians. And then that ended up being released as the third Big Star album. Again, low distribution, nobody heard it, but it was a great record. So therefore, that is where the history of Alex Chilton starts. And after that, Chilton leaves the business, then comes back and basically becomes a troubadour, playing on his own or with other bands, pickup bands, doing a lot of covers, doing a lot of interesting music for years and years. Then Big Star in the early 2000s got back together again with the Posies, put out a record, did some touring. Chilton would then tour with the Box Tops, you know, and then he passed away like 5 years ago, and that was that. So there you go. There's the history of Alex Chilton for you. That song, You and Your Sister, was a single released by Chris Bell, and Chilton does sing on it, but it's not a Big Star. But it sounds just like Big Star when you hear the original single. So there you go.
You know, just that title, You and Your Sister, sounds like something Beavis and Butthead would reply to.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right. Actually, it was the B-side. The original, the A-side, was a song called I Am the Cosmos. It's a very interesting So very interesting songs. You can find them on YouTube. So go look them at Chris Bell, Big Star, Alex Chilton. Have fun with it. So there you go.
There you go.
And back to our regularly scheduled program of comic books. So we were talking about Howard Chaykin, who said he stopped reading Fantastic Four when Jack Kirby left the book.
Yeah.
And I said I did too.
Yeah, what we were talking about was, I was surprised, again, on this, we're really promoting this podcast. I'll have a link on the episode. it's a good show, and especially the Howard Chaykin stuff. But somehow, I can't remember the context of it, but they talked about some comic publishers, and a lot of times when the new publisher comes out, they want to be the new Marvel Comics. And Howard Chaykin said, people say that, I don't know why, he says, you're never going to see another Marvel Comics. He said that was lightning in a bottle, which was true. It was. It was kind of a desperate try, and it worked. But he said he stopped reading when Jack Kirby left, and he basically brought up Fantastic Four. And Al said, I did too. Well, I do say that those 102 issues that Jack Kirby did are the greatest comic books ever done. But I read some of Rich Buckler's and other people. I really enjoyed them. I loved when George Perez. Yeah, George Perez did it. I thought it was fantastic.
John Buscema did it for a while.
Yeah, and I thought those were great. I didn't read every one. You know, you didn't see them all the time, but I'd buy them once in a while. My cousins would have them. I'd read them. They were neat. If I would have been around and read the Jack Kirby issues, I probably wouldn't have enjoyed or looked at the other ones. But those are the ones that... the first one I ever bought, we just moved to Oklahoma, I was 6 years old, and my mom let me get a comic book, and it was issue 67, the Fantastic Four. And the reason I got it, the thing fascinated me. The Human Torch, a guy on fire flying, yeah, and a stretching guy. That issue I didn't really think was all that great, you know. The Thing was mad, and they were going around town trying to stop him.
Yeah.
But that, you know, like I said, I'd read the Fantastic Four. There's some Rich Buckler issues that I just love to this day. It was a good comic.
Was your first introduction to the Fantastic Four the TV show?
No, it was 67. We just moved to Oklahoma. And 2 weeks later, I would start first grade. And, you know, we were moving the house, and everything was busy. And I was with my mom, and we went to a convenience store. And Mom let me get the comic book, and she let me get, it was called a Cooley. But, you know, it was an icy drink. And that was it. And I... you know, wasn't reading at the time, so my dad was telling me it was the Fantastic Four. And then, I don't know, later that week, it was Saturday morning, and my dad came and woke me up and said, Don, you know that comic book that you bought? It's on TV. What? Cool. I jumped up. Back then, you know, we lived in a few places. We lived in Texas, we lived in, you know, Denver, Colorado, and every time you go somewhere, the cartoons were completely different. You know, Denver, Colorado, there was Prince Planet, you know, and Marine Boy and stuff. I never saw those in Texas, and they didn't show in Oklahoma. So I just assumed the Fantastic Four was what they showed in Oklahoma. But yeah, that was... I had the comic book and then the cartoon, but the cartoon... if I would have got one of the issues of the Galactus trilogy, you know, as my first comic, I would have sought those things out. But, you know, the one I got, it wasn't quite the same.
The first one I bought was during when Dr. Doom took the Silver Surfer's power, so that was a pretty strong issue, so that's why.
What issue was that?
57.
Yeah, okay, I think I was 67. I may be wrong.
It was 1967, or late 66, but the issue was 57. That was the first one.
Yeah, I remember you talked about that. That's you were taught one
episode. Yeah, that was a heavy duty issue.
Yeah, it was a heavy duty issue. Everything had everybody was in it. It was a great story.
On the cover, everybody's in it. You're like, oh man, yeah. How much more do you want than this? And they were, and you know, not much.
But I was surprised when Howard Chaykin said that you know it was still he liked science fiction. He liked certain things. He's not a superhero guy, but he read the Fantastic Four, you know.
He's like a sword sorcery guy and a gangster guy.
Yeah.
Kind of. A sci-fi guy, kind of.
But, you know, whenever you talk about you like his older work, he talked about that in the episode that he didn't. He cringes when he sees it. I liked it. I bought sword
and sorcery.
Well,
some of this stuff going back, like the Mark of Cain, looks really sloppy. Mm. So I'm going to look at... I remember Cody Starbuck, or was one of those looking a little better, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah, it, like I said, sometimes it's... I still remember the Star Wars work he did. And then I'd see My Star is My Destiny, Cody Starbuck.
That was good, wasn't it? The Star is My Destination?
Yeah, they were fun, fantastic.
Yeah, those
were really
good.
And the painted Cody
yeah.
Starbuck stuff he did, it was unbelievable.
That was nice.
And I thought... Why did he do this on Star Wars? You know, so...
I think he didn't have much reference, and they really didn't know what the hell it was.
No, that's what he's talking about. He said he didn't... When he saw the movie, actually, he was shocked. And on the Star Wars DVDs, they talk about the making of it. And one thing I never thought about, they said when George Lucas was putting the film together after all this footage he shot, it wasn't working. And so they show it to audiences, and the audience was just kind of quiet. And they were trying to figure out what to do, so they basically brought in these two guys to edit. And what they started doing was to change scenes. They'd slow things down and transition different ways. It was interesting. I never thought of that.
That's a new article, isn't it? Because I think I've read that recently, where they said something like Star Wars was saved in the edits.
Yeah, it wasn't an article, it was a DVD.
Oh, somebody wrote about it recently.
Yeah. I bought the DVD, and when I was at the register, the girl said, it was at a movie stop, and she said, you know that's not the movie. Yeah, I know that. I enjoyed it, and like I said, my daughter loves Star Wars, and so I was talking to her, so I mailed it to her. But she has the Star Wars DVDs, and she said that's in there. Oh, okay. So I don't know why they put it out on a separate DVD of just that stuff, but I really enjoyed it.
Did the comic book come out way before the movie?
Yeah, I think
it did, huh?
I bought the fourth issue before they ever advertised the movie.
Because I remember buying the first issue and seeing the movie, so I must have enjoyed it. You know, I don't know. I liked Chaykin at the time, mm-hmm. You know. It was a rush job. You can look at it. If you look at it, it looked like he was rushing through it. You know, the first issue, pretty sketchy and, you know, kind of sloppy at times.
Oh,
but
it was
it had energy to it, and it was all right. I liked it.
When I say that, they put those books out, you know, the standard comic books. And then after the movie came out at Christmas time, they put them out in those tabloid-sized books for $1.50 or $2. And they had two of them, you know, I guess running the whole movie. And they'd have them everywhere. They even sold them at the toy department at JCPenney's, Sears.
Yep.
I mean, everywhere you went, they were there. They were 7-Elevens. But they had those big cardboard displays. And I'd pick it up because, again, I was wanting comic books. And so I love Star Wars, but I said, oh, this is the same stuff that they did. Howard Chaykin, how could you? But Dallas got those two. His mother or somebody bought them for him, and he just carries on like they're the greatest books in the world. well, you know, like I said, sometimes there's a lot of books I loved as a kid when I got them, thought they were the greatest. And when you see them later, you think, well, they weren't so much. I still remember them with fondness, but, you know... Again, if I would have read Jack Kirby's issues of the Fantastic Four all the way through, I probably never would have read anybody else's.
To me, it's like superhero comics. are Jack Kirby, and everybody else is an imitation of Jack Kirby. From that era on, not before, it was a different story, but after the 70s, everybody else is just like at the feet of Kirby. Now, I'm not saying they're not good artists or great artists, and they're doing really good work, but I'm just saying for me personally, I lost interest with a lot of superhero stuff. Because remember, after Kirby went to DC, all these different types of comics started coming out. Tarzan, Conan, horror was already out there. You know, all this other stuff was coming out, and the artwork was really nice. Sci-fi, the art was really nice, so the whole world opened up. It wasn't just guys in suits punching each other. It was like all these different types of, you know, worlds that you could see. So I went all over the place. I just kind of like, to me, it's like Buscema was told to lay out a story like Kirby. Okay, so it looked like Buscema, nice, doing Kirby. Okay, Rich Buckler, Kirby imitator, you know, and so on and so forth. Leo Adams was his own guy, but he wasn't doing as many comics anymore. George Perez was a new guy. Okay, different style, kind of crude at the beginning, but okay, whatever. You know, who else was, what, all the other guys, Starlin, you know, was a conglomeration of a lot of artists, you know. I mean, to me, it was just from the 60s on, well, you had Kane, but I don't know. I just lost interest, man. That's not to say I didn't buy them. I just lost interest. And because to me, the Fantastic Four was such a great book that everything else pales in comparison.
Yeah. You know, I think Will Eisner...
It's like the Beatles.
I think Will Eisner said this. I'm not positive. But he said, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster created Superman. Bob Kane and Bill Finger created Batman. Jack Kirby created everything else.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, I'll tell you the truth. His work in the 50s and is okay. I did like Fighting American, though. That was cool. But that 60s stuff is just too strong. You know, it's like the Beatles are my favorite group, and I think they're the best rock group ever. Mm. Doesn't mean I don't like other things, you know? And by other groups, of course I do. I shouldn't say the word pale in comparison. I just say it's like, to me, it's like influenced heavily by, and the Beatles were influenced by heavily by other artists, and Jack Kirby, I guess Hal Foster was an influence. I don't know. I've never read about who Kirby's influences, art influences were. I'm sure newspaper guys, Hal Foster, people like that, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, I think so. I just think he was one of those kind where he went past what he loved. He developed something that was completely different from everybody else.
He invented his own language of drawing. He didn't draw like anybody else.
I like what you said, invented his own language of drawing. That's absolutely...
I really do believe that. I don't think he drew like anybody else. I mean, you could tell he was a human being. Mm. But his style, his shorthand, his style of telling a story, having characters interact. I don't remember seeing any. He looked different from, when I was a kid, he looked different from everybody else. You know, it was like you had all the DC guys who kind of like fit the mold. Gil Kane was a little more dynamic, maybe. But Kirby was like, wow, this stuff is like crazy cool. You know, this guy can draw, he can design, he's coming up with all these things. And Stan Lee is selling the hell out of it. You know, I mean, it's great stuff. You know,
there's something I've never... Again, we talk about the Galactus trilogy. I just said that again. Somebody posted on Facebook, I don't remember what group it was, but they posted Jack Kirby's original pencils and his dialogue in the word balloons.
Uh-huh. I've seen that, yeah.
It was a lot different. You know, one thing, Jack Kirby was upset because when he introduced the Silver Surfer, you know, Stan Lee said, "Well, what is this?" And he said, "Well, if Galactus is a god, he needs a herald." And so he put in the Silver Surfer. But this is something I've always read about, that Jack Kirby was upset what Stan Lee did, because he added, you know, the Silver Surfer as Norrin Ran, and he had Shalabal, which these are things I liked. And how he agreed to become the the Silver Surfer to help Galactus if he'd spare his homeworld. I thought that was neat. But what Jack Kirby wanted to be was a being of pure energy that Galactus created. And then that dialogue that the Silver Surfer had with Alicia Masters was completely different. You know, she was teaching him, which was in the book, but Stan Lee completely changed that dialogue. And that's why at the end it scared Galactus, because Stan Lee added the ultimate nullifier. Well, again, that was something I liked. But it was a completely different take on what Jack Kirby put. I'll see if I can find it put on, because I'm kind of butchering it. But I think basically Alicia Masters was teaching the Silver Surfer about love or beauty. And then Stan Lee wrote something else.
Hmm. Well, yeah. Stan was the writer. Yeah. He was the writer.
Yeah, but I'm saying that. I love the Galactus trilogy as it was, you know, but yeah. I've kind of given Jack Kirby a slide over it, because I do think with Stan Lee, the stories were unsurpassed, but that one makes me wonder if it could have been better, you know?
I don't know. But, you know, we talk about the Fantastic Four, and, like, some kid, some guy in his 30s or 40s thinks the Image books are the greatest books ever made, you know?
So, and that's fine. I think it should be that way. Yeah. I think everybody should have their own time, you know.
Exactly.
I mean, you can appreciate, you know, what came before. We do. You start learning about, you know, old blues artists or old illustrators or anything like that. But I do think you need to find the time of your youth, you know, in your own way.
And sometimes I wonder, is it all nostalgia? Does it all just seem better? Because it was a time in your life when, you know, less problems, everybody was around. You know, that's got a tinge of memories to it, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, that's it. I mean, you know, as a kid, you got a lot of free time. Your parents taking care of all the problems. I mean, you know, you have problems.
Your big problem is if somebody's bullying you, or you got a test you didn't study for.
Yeah,
or,
exactly.
You know, whatever.
Yeah.
So it does get rose-colored a bit. But honestly, in the case of Kirby and a lot of these books, when I look at them, I really do believe that they are better than a lot of the stuff that's much better than a lot of stuff that's come since, I would say, the 90s, 2000s, maybe.
Mm.
You know, there's been great stuff.
Oh, yeah.
There's always new people coming in making great stuff, you know, or really good things.
And you just kind of led me into this. The last time we did an episode, I went to Yancey. You know, I was looking around. I did buy a couple of new books, but I was looking around the store, and I hit the dollar boxes. And I was going through there. And let me show you what I got.
Oh, looks like an old comic book.
Well, I got them. Dollar boxes, again, you don't know what you're going to get. And a lot of times, they may be something in the last 10 years, and that's fine, you know. But three different boxes, they had these. I can't stress to you, these things are really rough to rare, you know. I mean, they're worn. But I was so happy to get them.
Oh, yeah. Did Kirby do those? Was he doing one of those?
This is
that's Hollywood, isn't it, on Doctor Doom, or no?
This is Astonishing Tales, number 2, with Khazar and Doctor Doom. The Khazar story is by Jack Kirby, the King, and Al is correct. The Doctor Doom story is the Wally Wood story.
Oh, that's greatness, man.
I've seen the Wally Wood story on Facebook. I've read it online. Pretty neat.
Really nice Wally Wood art
It's nice Wally Wood art.
It's like, but he was earning it.
But like I said, I this one to me, it's just a great issue. I mean,
I love comics like that.
The
man.
Kirby story is strong. Well, Kraven the Hunter is, you know, he caught Cebu, and so Khazar goes to New York City to get him. And both stories are cliffhangers. You know, I don't know what happened, but I really enjoyed reading those. Okay, here's the next one.
Oh, man, with George Perez.
Yeah, Creatures on the Loose.
Creatures on the Loose, yeah.
Number 36. This is George Perez, inked by Frank McLaughlin, who I don't particularly care for, but...
It was either him or Klaus Janson on those issues,
yeah, well,
I
this
think.
Was Frank McLaughlin.
Yeah.
I read this issue. The kid I was telling you at school is a year older than I was. He had it. I read it on the school bus. And I'd read the Man-Wolf story in Spider-Man, and I was kind of fascinated that they're in space and there's barbarians. So, what?
Awesome.
Yeah, when I said I was surprised, it was an awesome surprise. And
who wrote that thing? Was it Jerry Conway or Doug Mensch or somebody like that?
David Kraft.
Oh, Dak. David Anthony Kraft, yeah.
Now, see, that was something that confused me, too, because I remember that issue. I was in seventh grade. Well, I think I was a junior or senior in high school. Marvel completed it. There was two issues, and I don't know what book it was, but George Perez drew them. And they were my favorite comics. Basically, they were on another planet, and they kept these characters in this book were referring to
Was it Man-Wolf J. Jonah Jones' son or something like that?
Yes.
Yeah,
but they
that's
kept
right.
referring to Man-Wolf as Star God. And he's like, I don't know what you're talking about. But I thought it was great. It was stunning George Perez work. I'm like, well, where are the other issues? This would be nice to have a whole collection. And so he was supposed to stay. I guess they were going to do a series and never did. But I'm glad they finished it up many, many years later. But yeah, he was J. Jonah Jameson's son. We talked about that with Dallas one time.
Yeah, we did do that one, yeah. That was a weird idea, but whatever. Like, J. Jonah Jameson's son was an astronaut or something.
He was an astronaut, and he came back, and he grew, I guess he could grow larger and stronger at one point. He was a superhero.
Yeah.
And then he became Man-Wolf. The poor guy, he accomplished a lot, but had a lot of trouble. Okay, buckle your seatbelt, Al.
Oh, shoot. Oh, yes. Ghost of Dr. Graves with probably some Ditko artwork in it.
Yeah, the front story is a...
Oops. Charlton Greatness. Reprint by Modern Comics, I think.
Yeah, this is a reprint from Modern Comics. This is number 12. The front story is The Ultimate Evil. And it's kind of a... Whenever I read Dr. Graves, he was like Rod Sterling. He would just appear between the stories and introduce them.
This one,
he's a Doctor Strange character. I mean, the story's about him, and he's, you know, he has an astral projection and all this other stuff. I mean, just look at the cover.
You know what's funny about his real name? I think the name they used for him was M.T. Graves, and M.T. Graves is the horror host we used to have back in Miami, so good old M.T. Graves. Yeah, oh, that's early Ditko, man. Those are early reprints.
What
nice.
Do they look like? It looks like Doctor Strange.
Yeah, you're not kidding me.
I've never seen this. You know,
Ditko's such a great storyteller.
Oh, yeah. Again, we were just talking about Jack Kirby. Steve Ditko, he was great another one. There was no one like him.
No one like him. Yeah, look at all that, those mystical worlds there. It's Doctor Strange.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
I will say this. I read Steve Ditko was interviewed, and I was interested in what he said because he felt bad when he went to publishers and he created things and did work that they weren't big selling pieces. And I never heard anybody say that. I imagine people feel that way. But he didn't rest on laurels. Like, he was saying, hey, I created Spider-Man, you know, or, you know, I created Doctor Strange.
Kiss my butt, I created Spider-Man, yeah.
He, you know, these kids don't know what they want. Don't they know who I, you know, he never did that. And I mean, I bought his stuff. I liked it. Sometimes I do think it got kind of wonky.
Sure.
And you know, on a side note, my partner at work is from Pennsylvania, Erie, Pennsylvania. And he
Oh, ask him. Is he your age or is he younger?
A little bit younger. He's 53.
Ask him if he watched Chili Billy as a kid. Chili Billy was a famous horror host in Pennsylvania.
I'll ask him. One thing, he loves Godzilla movies. Of course, he and I are friends.
He had to have watched Chili Billy then.
But
yeah,
he brought me in, I think, 15 Godzilla movies on DVD. And,
yeah.
But when we talk about cartoons, he doesn't, you know, it was never an interest. And he said, it's one I hear a lot. When I discovered girls, I never, you know, paid attention. And he was out. He had a band. He was playing at night. So I don't know if he ever would have seen that stuff. I will check.
Yeah, was he into comic books at all?
Not at all. No.
Mm, okay.
When I talk to him about it, it's almost like if I'm, you know, teaching
foreign
Hindu
language,
religion.
Really.
You know, if I'm teaching him Hindu religion or something.
Vulcan, something like that.
But anyway, he was saying, he said something about wonky. And he said him and his wife were talking about, everybody uses that term wonky down here. He says, what does it mean? And I said, well, I never thought about it. I guess I never realized it was something we used down here. And I said, well, it's like loopy or quirky, sort of. So we looked it up on Google. I said, just look it up at Google. He typed it in, read the description. Oh, yeah, it is. It is kind of like that. So all day, no matter what happened.
Everything was wonky.
Yeah, he'd say, oh, that's wonky. Yeah, it's kind of wonky, isn't it?
Kind of, the weather's kind of wonky, isn't it, today? Yeah, kind of, sort of.
Yeah, Al, that guy you do the show with is really wonky, isn't he? Yeah.
Yeah, wonky, yeah. The whole show was wonky, damn it. Anyway.
Okay.
Keep going with the comics. Let's see what else you got.
Anyway, ready?
Yes. Oh, that's not Joe Kubert, though, right? That's post-Kubert. Oh, yeah, nice, yeah. Was it Garcia Lopez the artist on those, or was it somebody else? Jose Delbo, maybe, or somebody?
They looked like Kubert, but,
No, those aren't Kubert issues.
Well, it's laid out like Joe Kubert.
It's laid out like Joe Kubert, yeah. It's a Filipino, isn't it?
I was going to say, this looks like Nestor Redondo.
Probably, or one of those guys. Yeah, it looks nice.
Yeah, but I mean,
it's beautiful.
It's laid out. Joe Kubert would lay things out in Nestor Redondo, like Rima the Jungle Girl.
You know that was a movie, right, called Green Mansion?
Yeah, we talked about it on the show. That's how I learned about it.
Yeah, with Audrey Hepburn.
But,
weird.
Like I said, I read this, and when I saw it, I thought this was Joe Kubert. Inked by Nestor Redondo, but it doesn't have any signing. I know Kubert did the cover.
It doesn't have any credits on it.
That's what I'm looking for. No,
that is odd.
But I enjoyed it, even though it has a tear on the cover, as you see.
That's okay.
I was happy. The second one. Yeah. Same thing.
No credits, huh?
No credits, but it looks like it was laid out by Kubert.
You're not kidding.
And I mean, I have to say, it even looked like it was drawn by Joe Kubert, but finished by Nestor Redondo. This one's about a boxer.
Yeah.
And the boxer goes down to Africa on a ship, and he's hunting animals. And it's a cliffhanger of an ending. It didn't finish. But Tarzan has to stop him. So Tarzan, of course, beats the world champion boxer to a standstill. But at the last page, look out, Tarzan. He's taking his jacket off. So this time it's serious.
And that's the way it ends right there?
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
So
fun stuff, man.
Well, like I said, I never bought the Tarzan stuff when it came out. One time I went down to Texas and my grandmother found a few comic books at the flea market and got them for me because, you know, I was a comic kid. And one of them was Tarzan, the Joe Kubert. And I read it. I wasn't really thrilled to get it. Again, I had a bunch of war books my neighbor gave me, and Joe Kubert did the covers. The covers fascinated me. I thought they were incredible. But they looked sad, you know. I was a kid. I wanted happy things. I wanted, right. You know. I mean, there was enough sadness in my life, I guess. Yeah. I was a skinny, twerpy kid. I wanted to read what I wanted to become, you know.
Hey, you know, it's funny because you talk about ages or whatever. I'm like 3 or 4 years older than you. Yeah. And when you start buying comics, the first stuff you buy usually is like the stuff that makes the biggest impression of you. But yeah. If you think about the, even now it doesn't seem like much, but if you think about it back then, a gap of 3 or 4 years, it's like, that's like the Beatles in 65 and the Beatles in 69 when it's almost over. You know what I mean? It's like a big deal because if you're talking about eras of things, half a decade or a little bit less than half a decade makes the biggest difference in the world. So when you started, I mean, I was buying those. I wasn't buying those issues, but I remember buying the Kubert ones off the stand, selling them and loving them. You know, but it's like, it's funny when you say, well, I never bought them because I was this and that. And I was like, yeah, it's so weird.
Well,
that now we're into the same thing. But back then, it was different because,
As a kid, just a few years is a big difference.
It's a big difference,
you know? So you were looking at it with an older person's eyes. I mean, you had
even though I'm not that much older, but
But if you and I would have met back then, you wouldn't have given me the time of day. I was some twippy kid that, you know, hey, how are you doing?
You would have been like my friend's brother. who was a nice guy.
Yeah.
And I hung out with him a few times, but I hung out mostly with the guy that I was going to school with. We were in the same age group whatever. Yeah.
That would be different. If I had an older brother and you were friends with him, then yeah. But just a few years is a big difference when you're a little kid.
Or
a young person. So, I mean, that's it.
If you're like 14, and if I'm 14 and you're 9 or 10, it's a big difference.
Yeah, well, that's it. When I got that age, I started really appreciating Joe Kubert.
Yeah.
And I started liking the stuff he did. It's when you and I started doing the show, when you were talking about Tarzan, I was finding images for the blog. And there was one 2-page spread that I found, and I stopped breathing for a minute. It was Law of Opar. It was a 2-page spread, and it was Law of Opar with all of her people around her, and they have somebody up on an altar, and she's getting ready to sacrifice them. And then if you look in the far top left, you can see Tarzan up on top of something getting ready to come down. My God, why didn't I buy these? And I was always wishing I had that issue. And then the infamous day that we were at Wilson's and you found all those Bronze Age comic books for $1.
Oh, yeah.
That was one of the issues I got. You and I went through the Tarzans. You took half. I took the other half. And that was in there.
That's awesome.
Saying this thing must have been used as a fly swatter. It didn't matter. I still love it just as much as if it was a pristine copy. The Joe Kubert Tarzans were second to none. But when you're a kid, it didn't appeal to me, you know.
Because you wanted Man-Wolf.
Yeah, well, it was that kind of thing. You're looking at it from a different time in your life. And like I said, a few years later when I caught up to you, again, a few years later now is nothing. But back then, just a few years is everything.
Think about it this way. If you're 10... And it's a 4-year difference. That's half your life, man.
Oh, yeah. That's something I've always said. People talk about time flies when you're older, which is true. I remember when I was 13, I was starting to notice that the year was flying by before the school year was an eternity. And my mom said, well, you're going to find the older you get, the faster things go. And she's right. But I think a lot of it was when you're a kid, you can't really do anything. You're basically waiting. You know,
yeah, right.
You're waiting if you can go to the store. You're waiting, you know, when do we go to the amusement park? You're waiting if your parents let you go to the
movies. You have your bike, but, you know.
Oh, well, I did stuff. I'd ride the convenience store. Those are things you could do, but you were basically hanging out with your friends, you know, sitting around somebody's room, waiting for, this is, again, in the 60s. You're waiting until a TV show would come on that you want to watch instead of the news.
Or you're out playing basketball or something.
Yeah. But then you're older, you're working, and then you get off and you do things you want to do, and you go sleep. It's basically, all of a sudden you have freedom. You can go anywhere you want. You can do anything you want. I mean, to limits, if you can afford it. But all of a sudden, anything you want to do, you can just do. You don't have to wait for permission. You don't have to wait for somebody to do it. And again, you're busy, you're working this and that. So I think that's why everything starts to blur. You have a lot of freedom, and you also have a lot of responsibility and not a lot of time.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, that's it.
Anyway.
So anyway, what other classics do you got there? Oh, my God, Jughead. Sam Schwartz, maybe?
Yeah, Sam Schwartz. They're all Sam Schwartz.
Nice.
This is later Sam Schwartz, though. I mean, it's...
Yeah, 80s.
Yeah, it's kind of rough, you know.
Yeah.
You can see it's still good. I enjoyed them, but his best work's behind him. They're not as tight as his older work, and they're kind of
loose.
Yeah,
sure, yeah. Oh, man. Man, you are... Oh, Pep. You got some Pep there.
Now, Pep isn't one I read much.
Pep looks like early 70s or mid-70s.
Yeah, this one was 74.
Yeah.
Now, the Pep was a book I didn't read much. Once in a while, my brother and I would buy one because we liked the Dan DiCarlo cover. They always had Dan DiCarlo covers.
Yeah.
But I don't know who drew this.
Oh, boy, can you bring it closer? You know, you can always look it up.
Yeah.
But it looks nice.
I didn't mind it.
Yeah, I don't know.
But, I mean, I read it. It was fun.
Archie. Is that? No, that's not Lucy. Lucy passed away by then, probably, right? Or
it was Dan DiCarlo Jr.
Oh, cool. Oh, man.
There is a Harry Lucy story in one of these, but it was a later Harry Lucy story. And
yeah, more Archie. You cleaned up, man. Nice.
It was.
Who's the artist on? Does it give credits or no?
This doesn't, but this is Dan DiCarlo. This is definitely Dan DiCarlo. I actually had this issue when I was in high school.
That other one you showed me where you didn't see the art, that might be like Dick Malmgren or somebody like that, or Stan G. Well, I don't think it's Stan G.
It wasn't Stan G. I would have recognized him.
No, it might be Dick Malmgren or something. That's DiCarlo.
Yeah, I had this issue when I was in high school. I think I still have it, but I bought it anyway.
That's Betty and Veronica. What issue is that?
297.
Okay.
But, you know, that's the point on those. I was so happy to get them. And that's something I started thinking about. I never stopped loving comics. I love modern comics. I get a lot of them. And a lot of stuff that came up past then, I'm really fond of, and some of my favorite stuff. But I guess this kind of ties into what you're saying before. These are from my childhood, and when I saw these, it was a different kind of concept, because these were mass media books. They were to entertain the masses, and they were cheap entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And I bought these, and I thought, and it was so much fun to get them out and read them. I mean, I just plowed through these things. They were kind of light reading, kind of fun reading, and but I don't know, it went from kind of a ho-hum time at the comic store to all of a sudden, wow, everything was color, bubblegum was everywhere, you know what I mean? It's just...
When you were a kid, did you buy, cards, you know, bubblegum cards or whatever.
Not much. I did a few times. The ones I got was a Marvel in 75. They had those stickers. They were cards, but they were stickers.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were just stock poses of the characters, but they'd always... I remember I had Reed Richards stretching, and he said, "I'm the long arm of the law," you know, and they were corny. But they always had a word bubble, but it was basically a pose they got out of a comic book, and it was die cut, so you could peel the sticker out, stick on something. They were all goofy.
Well, you bought wacky packages and all that.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. I bought wacky. I bought Odd Rods, the bubblegum stuff.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
I bought some cards. I remember it was later when I was in high school. Topps put out Kiss. Those Kiss cards.
You got those, huh?
I got a bunch of those. And then I had some Space 1999 cards. A bunch of those. But when I was a little kid, no. I remember one of my best friends... He lived to get Partridge Family cards. I mean, he had billions. And every time we go to the store, we get money. You could get a candy bar for a dime. So his mom would give us a dime. And he was wanting to get Partridge Family cards, which were 15 cents. And his mom would say no. And I mean, he had 50 billion of them. But I don't know. I remember as a kid, I got those Batman cards that were painted by Earl Norm, I think.
Yeah, those are great.
You say that, but I remember when I got
actually,
them.
Actually, they were painted by Norman Saunders.
Oh, Norman Saunders? Those creep me out.
I know what you mean.
I've seen some online. Well, those aren't so bad, but again, I posted on the blog before. It was Batman and the Whirlpool.
I know what you mean.
I was like, wait, Batman's, is he going to live?
Yeah, I know.
They were creepy, and they weren't comfortable looking.
I know what you mean.
And I got a Munsters, that TV show, The Munsters. They had them. I bought a card or a pack of them. My aunt was with me, and I said, "Where's the gum?" Because it always came with that dry stick of rectangle gum
that cracked in your mouth. Yeah.
Nevertheless, I chewed it, and I was like, "There's no gum." I was so disappointed. She goes, "There's no gum in this. It said free sticker." And it was a sticker, you know, a card-shaped sticker of Grandpa that was kind of green-hued. Well, I would have rather had the bubble gum. And, so, I don't know, that was kind of my card collecting experience. I have some. When I was an adult, I had a daughter, when the Batman animated series was on TV, I got those. There was some store that had them, and they were just selling them off, and I got all of them. I've got them in a little book. I love that show, so I kind of enjoyed getting the cards. But
I remember in the cards, sometimes a stick of gum in the back, if it was there for a long time, would make like a, in like not like a like a. It was almost like it made like an image on the back of the card. It was like, you know, it was like, it's been there so long, it made like a little square. Usually in football or baseball cards or whatever, and I was like, okay.
Well, there was a guy that worked for me that was getting . Yeah, he collected baseball cards. I mean, it was him and his son were doing that.
Yeah.
And I asked him about the gum. And he says, "Oh, they don't put gum in the cards anymore." He says, "People asked them not to because it's messing the cards up." I remember sometimes friends of mine would get cards when I was a kid all the way up through high school. And they would throw the gum away. I said, "What is wrong with you?"
Yeah, I'd eat it.
And, it's gum.
Sure.
And, one time somebody says, "You want this? You don't want it?" "Yeah, I hate it." "Okay, yeah, I'll chew it." And, you know, I mean, it had that kind of powder sugar thing on it, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Even though it cracked, it still chewed and tasted like bubble gum.
Hey, you paid a big 5 cents for it or 10 cents. You got to get all of it.
Yeah, I mean, it was part of the experience.
Sometimes they would, instead of gum, they would give you like this little. I think it was with the sports card. They would give you like a little round, like almost looked like a pog, with a little picture of the player or whatever instead of gum. But usually they brought gum.
Well, that's kind of neat too. I mean,
can you imagine if that's, they still have them? People that have complete boxes of cards. with the gum still in it from like 60 years ago. I mean, that's disgusting. Gotta eat the gum. No, no way.
I wonder if, you know, I've done that. It's probably stale.
It's probably turned into something else, man. I wouldn't do it. But yeah, you see guys online, hey, we got a complete box of 1960 whatever Tops football cards. Yeah, I'll leave the gum. Don't take the gum.
No, always take the gum. You know, okay. Some friends of mine are from Colombia, and they were telling me about this candy bar called Jet, and it came with stickers. It was a candy bar, chocolate bar. And they said, really? And he said, oh, yeah, and they're very collectible. They said you could get books, you know, the sticker books like you had here. But she said they were birds. And that kind of fascinated me. And another woman I knew from Columbia said, oh, you're talking about Jet. Yeah, they're very collectible. And she said, if I ever go back to Columbia, I'll bring you some. Oh, one of them did. But they weren't the full-size candy bars. They were little ones. She brought me a cellophane pack of like 8. And they came, they weren't birds, they were different kinds of animals, like National Geographic. But they came out kind of like cards shaped like the candy bar. But they were stickers you could put in the book. I know, that's neat. I always thought it'd be neat, whenever you bought a chocolate bar, if it came with a comic strip, like Bazooka Joe Bubblegum or
Bazooka,
something.
Bazooka, yeah.
But I mean, good comic strips.
Yeah, I never read Bazooka Joe. I was like...
I did. I always read them, and I enjoyed them. When I was in fourth grade, I don't know why, for some reason, our next-door neighbors had Bazooka Joe bubblegum, and then we all went trick-or-treating. And you know, your Halloween basket, you go through it in layers, and we always had Bazooka Joe bubblegum. For some reason, we were saving the wrappers. Oh, it's because you could save up some money and get a camera or a telescope or something, which we never did. But I enjoyed them. As bad as they were, I still liked them.
And well, they were tiny and hard to read.
On the ship, some guy got Bazooka Joe bubblegum. And on the flight deck, everybody's chewing it. And I remember our division officer when it walked up to him. And this guy was a real aristocrat. You know, he was a professional bridge player. His family had money, and he kind of spoke down to us like we were all unwashed masses. And I remember he was walking up to this guy. He says, "Where's the bubble gum? I want some bubble gum." And I'm thinking, wait a minute, what? This guy is, you know, he's talking to him that way. And he says, I'm out. But his girlfriend would send me boxes of the stuff. And, you know, everybody was chewing it. Everybody, you know, you were happy to get that little tiny slip. You know, again, the ship is a dismal place, a lot of work. You're not pulling a civilization. And, you know, you're not really getting periodicals and stuff much. So, you know, that little thing was, it was a penny from heaven.
Speaking of the Navy... I just found this. I can't show it to you because for some reason my camera's not working. But I found, I guess I bought this at the store here, cheap too, for like $1. It's one of those Classics Illustrated. It's the larger size one. It's called The World Around Us. It's the illustrated story of the Navy with art by George McCann and Sam Glansman. So there
you go. You know, Sam Glansman, he did those Marvel graphic novels is towards the end. He did the Sailor story.
Yeah, that was great stuff.
That was great stuff. He made a second one. I didn't know that. I never saw the second one. But he was telling his life story in World War II, and that was incredible. I still remember Comics Journal, who was poo-pooing on anything the mainstream was doing, especially Marvel. This is in the late 80s. And one of the books, one of the issues, they were talking about the Sailor story. And the guy said, well, I can't believe I'm coming on here and even seeing this, but this is really good and you should get it. Well, yeah, it was great. But I'd like to find the second one. Sam Gladman, he was a great artist, and he was a good storyteller and a good writer.
When I was a kid, I thought he was kind of like a lesser Joe Kubert, but I really like his artwork now. I really do.
There's a lot of those guys that I... Frank Thorne, I always thought...
I know.
You know, was a lesser... But I do say Frank Thorne came into his own later. I loved him.
But I never liked the way Frank Thorne drew Red Sonja's hair. I just never liked it. It looked just bizarre.
I've got every one of those Red Sonjas he did. Those are some of my favorites. And what I loved was when he laid things out, like I think it was the second issue of Red Sonja. It was a story called The Maze. And it was a two-page spread. And just how he put the title, the design, The Maze. And the whole layout was incredible. Again, it was different to Kubert, but Kubert did really neat layouts with loose drawings. What I didn't like about Frank Thorne was sometimes how he'd finish ladies' hair and stuff. It would be like spider webs.
Yeah.
You know, that was just his way of doing it. I mean, I didn't hate it. It wasn't like I lost sleep, but it wasn't something I cared for.
No.
Red Sonja's hair I did like, but that was, again, he just didn't etch in all the spider webs at the end of her hair.
He did like a Red Sonja. He did a lot of Red Sonja knockoffs, but he did one for Warren, and it was really dirty. And really, he drew Red Sonja's hair looking like matted, but it was just bad. It was like, whatever. Look it up. Look it up for, if anybody's interested, look it up for yourself. I'm not going to get it. It's just bad. Anyway, yeah, but I want to ask you a question about the Navy.
Yeah.
I finally watched the movie Jaws, okay? My friends finally put it in front of me and said, you have to watch this now. I'm like, okay. So I watched the movie, right? Did you see Jaws, right?
Oh, yeah.
I saw it back in... Is that story that... I know it's true, but I wanted to know if you knew much about it. That story that the captain says about, I think it's the USS Indianapolis.
Yeah.
That is a true story, huh?
No, I only saw it on the movie.
That they were all eaten by... They sunk the thing, and while they were waiting to be saved, sharks were eating them up or whatever.
Richard Dreyfuss knew.
I think it was a true story.
Well, you know, Sam Gladman in that sailor story, he talked about his ship sank. And they were out in the water, you know, on life preservers and stuff, and they watched their ship sink. I can't imagine what that's like.
I think it was a submarine, but anyway, yeah.
Yeah, well, like I said, when I was in, ships didn't really sink. We weren't at war.
Right.
You know,
right.
Well, I mean, there was things going on.
You were the Gulf War, though. Weren't you in the Gulf War or no?
No, I got out. I was in reserves, and then right before I was offered a position in my job, that it was going to be hard for me to do in the reserves. I had to drive to Jacksonville, which was 4.5 hours every month, and they were putting me on nights, and I just thought, this is going to be 2 months. So I got out, and right after I got out, that's when Desert Shield occurred.
Mm.
And some of the guys in my unit, not all of them, but some of the guys in my unit got called back when Desert Storm occurred. So I don't know. In Annapolis, I'm sure it's true. I'm sure a lot of times guys sank in a ship and there were sharks in the water. I mean...
As a weird story. Then I later found out that whole scene was... That whole story was written by John Milius, I think uncredited, in the movie. John Milius being the guy who directed Conan and a bunch of other...
Oh, he was a screenwriter?
He was a screenwriter and a director. He was an all-around... He was part of the Lucas... Spielberg, USC guys or whatever, but yeah. He directed Wind in the Lion, Conan.
I thought Spielberg directed that movie.
No.
Jaws?
No. Milius wrote that scene.
Oh, but Spielberg directed
the movie.
Okay, alright.
Yeah, but anyway, I just thought about that. I was like, oh, it's a true story, but it's just weird. You know, I didn't know if you knew much about it. Also.
No, I didn't. I'm sure... No. It could be true. I took it as true.
That's pretty messed up. But anyway.
Now, you know, one thing when you're talking about Jaws, you saw it last episode. There was a woman I worked with that she was always, whenever Jaws came up, She talked about it. She was enamored with part of it. But it wasn't what I was expecting. What she loved about the movie was he had three different men in the main characters in that movie. They were, had completely different backgrounds, nothing in common with each other. And it was always that part, the one you're talking about on the boat, where they're getting drunk.
Yeah, that's it.
And they all start relating to each other and became friends.
That's it,
and,
yeah.
And, you know, she was just always, just that's how she remembers the movie. Again, when people think of the movie, they think of the mechanical shark, and they think of the fear, and, you know, doom, 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 you know, all that, which is greatness. But to me, that's the key, is you got three different people, completely different, and all of a sudden they become friends. So all it tells you is all you need is alcohol.
I did see another 70s movie I'd never seen before, but it wasn't on the level of Jaws. But it's not a bad movie. You ever seen what we call The Conversation?
No, never heard of it.
And it's a very interesting movie. It's directed by Coppola right after Godfather 2, I think. And it's basically starring Gene Hackman, and he's an eavesdropper. He's one of those guys that spies on people and blah, blah, blah for a living. So in the beginning of it, you see him, he's spying on these two. It's this, what looks like a young couple or whatever. And it's the actors are Cindy Williams and Frederick Forrest. And it was an interesting movie. I mean, it goes on a little too long, but it's a really creepy take on surveillance. Let's put it that way. It's a highly rated movie, you know what I mean? But it's just like, oh, it's not what I expected it to be. It turns out it's a thriller. So it's a very good movie too, but that's another 70s movie that I hadn't seen before, which I can now say that I have seen. So there's a few other ones. So I'm checking them off little by little, you know what I mean? So there you go. And you're looking at a comic book.
No, I'm not. I was looking at a message somebody sent me. I got a question. Well,
yeah, go ahead.
You're starting to expand your horizons. Why?
Oh, I don't know. My friend loaned them to me. That's my reason why.
Yeah, but...
And then I said, well, you know, maybe I should watch some of these movies that I never got around to see. I can't think of them off the top of my head right now, but there's ones that I haven't seen before that are quote-unquote important movies. That I just never, you know, it's like what I was telling my friend, when at the time you went to the movies, what was around, and you watched it, if you missed it, you'd never get around to seeing it on TV for years later. So it was just like you forgot about it, and you moved on to other movies, you know? So.
No, I completely agree. I mean, that's, you know, that's sometimes when people talk about the 90s, comics in the 90s. You know, when you think of that, everybody's always thinking of the Image comics or the Marvel comics that the Image creators were doing before they created Image. And I never read those. You know, I mean, I looked at them a couple of times. They just weren't in my ballpark. But people think, well, that's the only thing around. Why were you reading? Well, they were reprinting all those Carl Barks stories. I was getting those. I was always searching for Alan Davis' work. You know, I stopped buying Excalibur, and then later I thought, wait, why did I do that? These are great. And I started buying them again. There was always books I liked to get, and I never bought those Alan Moore, America's Best Comics he did, Promethea and Tom Strong, you know, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Right.
And then later, after I got to know Dallas, I started, you know, buying them. Loving them. I mean, just because you didn't get it when it came out doesn't mean you can't get it later and enjoy it.
And he did that Supreme book with Rob Liefeld, too.
Yeah.
I think it was called Supreme. It was like a take on Superman or something.
Yeah, Alan Moore?
I think he did. I think he worked on those, too.
Yeah, he did. Alan Moore did some work for, I think he did an issue for Todd McFarlane. He wrote Spawn.
Spawn.
Yeah, and then he did some work for Rob Liefeld a little bit. You know, just not a lot. He was contracted. He was in an interview, and I guess they said something about Rob Liefeld. And he said, well, when he was working for him, he asked one of the people that was liaison to Alan Moore, said Rob was asking him, what did you think of his art? And Alan Moore said, well, one thing he brought up, he was lacking on drawing incidental things like, you know, lamps and tables and windows and that kind of thing. And, I mean, he was really eloquent what he said, and all Rob Liefeld said when he heard it was, I don't want to draw windows.
Okay.
Well.
All right, then.
I think what the joke was, he kind of missed the point, but, you know, he had his own way of doing things, I guess. But
yeah,
I thought that was strange that Alan Moore was, you know, doing work for those two guys. But from what I understand, he did good. I mean, he put, you know, all of his powers into the project.
He didn't want to work for the big two, I think.
Yeah, Dallas gave me a book, and they were talking about that. That after Alan Moore, you know, stopped working for DC, he financed a family member for a greenhouse, and I guess the business failed, and he was strapped for cash, and so these guys were off from work, so he took the work, and, you know, he did some other stuff.
Did Alan Moore ever work for Marvel?
No.
Never did, huh? Wow.
He wrote for Marvel UK.
Marvel UK, that's right.
And that was kind
Captain
of an
Britain.
Issue.
Captain Britain.
Yeah, which I love. The Captain Britain work that him and Alan Davis did was fantastic. And Alan Davis kept going with it. All the way up through Excalibur. If you read all of Alan Davis's Captain Britain work before Alan Moore and after Alan Moore, and then it ties into the X-Men and New Mutants, and then it goes into Excalibur, it's kind of incredible. It tells a whole story that ties into that Phoenix, you know, the Dark Phoenix story that John Byrne and Chris Claremont, Terry Austin did. I think it's genius. I just wish there wasn't all those fill-in issues by other people in between them.
They're pretty bad.
Well, I thought so, but, you know. But, yeah, those are nice. But, yeah, and that was an issue. I was reading Alan Davis. They were putting out Captain Britain Monthly here in the United States. It was a magazine size. They did 13 issues. I didn't like the other strips in the book, but I loved Captain Britain. And then he started doing, at the same time, was drawing Batman and the Outsiders for that year. And that's when I liked Alan Davis. And then Amazing Heroes had a book, and the cover had a D.R. and Quench, had Captain Britain and Miracle Man, and it said, England's Other Alan. And I was reading this, I said, wait a minute, this guy did Miracle Man? I didn't realize that the guy drawing Captain Britain was the same guy drawing Batman and the Outsiders. So that's when I started getting Miracle Man and was blown away. And I've just lost my whole point of thought. why was it?
Alan Davis, Alan Moore.
Oh, yeah, I think so. That's what the issue was Miracle Man, there was a problem. You know, Eclipse put it out, and it was a huge success. But it kept getting hung up. And one of the plans were that once they finished all the stuff they were putting in Warrior Magazine from 82, Alan Moore and Alan Davis would pick up and carry on with it, which would have made sense. But Alan Davis is getting upset because Marvel UK had this weird copyright thing that it wasn't the same way as it was done in the States. Since they were working on it, Marvel had the copyright, but so did Alan Moore and Alan Davis. They had a percentage of it. So to get something put out, all the creators had to sign off on it.
Okay.
And Alan Moore wouldn't sign off on the Captain Britain work he did because he was upset at Marvel for the treatment of the King, of Jack Kirby. So he wouldn't sign it. Well, Alan Davis got really upset about it because to him it was prominent work he did, and that was a great series. And, you know, It was only done in Marvel UK. It would have been a big audience. It was here in the United States. It would have got him, you know, a lot of notice. So he said he was wrong in doing this, but he got upset. So with the Captain, with the Miracle Man stuff, Marvel Man at the time, he wouldn't cooperate. And that's why him and Alan Moore has never worked again together. One of the Delaney brothers, I think it was Delaney, yeah, at Eclipse is really upset and wouldn't talk to him at the time. And I don't know how they got around to putting that stuff out, but that's why they had trouble finding another artist. They got that, they got one guy that didn't do it. He was a good art, Chuck Austin. I think he did a good artist that didn't do a good job on the book. And then later they got, I think, John Tottleman, which, you know, I liked.
Yeah, I remember those, but anyway, I think we better get going.
It's
pretty much.
Hey, what
we got like a, we did like an hour and 20 minutes or something in the second half.
That's a short episode for you and I. Yeah. All right, man. Well, listen, it's been great. It's kind of funny. I came to this thinking, well, I don't know what we're going to talk about.
So, yeah, we usually figure something out.
Anyway, everybody, thank you very much for listening. If you could, please leave us an iTunes review. That really helps us out a lot. It's not hard to do. And if you're listening to this from another podcatcher site, please feel free to leave us a review there as well. It can only help us out. And if you're so inclined, if you like to draw, we use covers, fake covers we do every episode on the Facebook page. If you'd like to do one, feel free, just join in. It'd be yours. We don't claim ownership to it. If you would allow us to, we'd put it on the blog under comic covers. If you'd like to see what I'm talking about, just go to that. Al's done several fantastic ones. As a matter of fact, he did this episode's cover. And anything you got, buddy?
No, that's it, man. I just found out. I just saw. I got to figure this out. In the settings, it says camera's not found, so I got to... After we're done, I want to investigate this and see how I can fix that.
All right, and in between writing reviews and drawing covers, if you can come up to Horse Country and help Al find his camera, we'd appreciate it.
Yeah, there you go.
All right. That's all it. Right. So in the meantime, read...
More...
Comics.